The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight for May is the Susan G. Komen Global Race for the Cure, happening Saturday, June 4th on the National Mall. Whether you run, walk, or in the case of our WTOP colleagues, sleep, we can help end breast cancer forever. Join WTOP as they sleep in for the cure. Fight breast cancer without leaving your bed. Donate today at WTOP.com, search sleep. This message brought to you by Papa John's and Federal News Radio.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
Anthony Principi is former VA secretary and chairman of the BRAC Commission.
Our decision was to take personnel out of leased space in Arlington and surrounding communities and place them on Fort Belvoir. Sometime after BRAC concluded and made its report to the president and the Congress, an amendment to some bill mandated that the Seminary Road area was a satellite of Fort Belvoir. Incredulous to me.
Hear the entire interview online. federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about umbrella policies, property casualty, liability insurance, and more importantly, financial planning. And to lead us in that discussion is John Gillick, Certified Financial Planner, Financial Advisor with Edward Jones. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Good to have you here. I'm looking forward to learning lots about finances. And John Elliott, fellow seminar presenter, federal benefit strategist, retired Fed, and answerer of emails.
Yes.
Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, John. And if you want for this show, you can call me Jack to avoid any confusion.
Okay, Jack.
Yeah.
All righty, John. Before. Let's go into the first area. What is an umbrella policy?
An umbrella policy, Bob, covers you for liability beyond your normal auto policy limits. And, excuse me, the right around $1 million is where you would start with an umbrella, typically. And if you are in an accident, a good example would be, say, you had run into a luxury vehicle and your policy limits did not cover the restructuring or rebuilding of that vehicle. It's where $1 million or an umbrella-type policy would fit in or would take care of you from that point forward.
So an umbrella kind of is a concept that it would cover you for a lot of things should the rain hit you.
That's correct.
So we're buying a policy. We have an automobile policy. Or we have some kind of household insurance and the like, and it says it's going to cover us for X. But for most of us, we don't read the policy line by line. We just kind of, okay, good, I'm covered. And so this would say, okay, you got your basic coverage, but in today's world, you could have an unfortunate accident, or somebody that's insured in the household could have an unfortunate accident. And this would cover us. I'm not saying it would cover everything, but it would cover some of the basic large things.
That's correct.
Yeah. There was a unfortunate accident locally here, and I'm sure it's no different than anybody else listening to other town in the country. And there were three, I think it was three, early 20s, late teens that died in an automobile accident. But I'd imagine the driver of the automobile policy would be step in to handle whatever claims there may be for the other two. Can you buy an umbrella policy for that, especially if you got young drivers in your family?
Unfortunately, my understanding with the young drivers, and I don't handle property casualty myself, but my understanding with young drivers is that once you have a young driver, you have a near-term young driver, the companies out there will not actually write you an umbrella policy because of the teen driver on your policy. So it's actually a very valid point if you have a teenage driver, an up-and-coming teenage driver, to look into an umbrella policy prior to them taking the wheel, because it might not be something you can get once they are behind the wheel.
And umbrella policies can be available. It doesn't have to be with the same insurance company that insures the automobile, for example, or the home. It can be outside of that, or does it have
to be? It can be outside, but I think everybody now is familiar with Flo on TV and the Geico Gecko, and what you'll hear Flo say over and over is bundling, but I really don't think folks understand that concept. And what insurance companies did, my personal agent, his name's Bill, called and said one day, "Hey, John, I've got a new policy here with the company you're through. I'm underwritten through a company, Safeco. In order to get you on this new policy, we need to take your home, your auto, and your liability over to a new platform they've developed." And what apparently they do on this new platform is they look at all of your insurances together. And they would think, in a case like myself, the chances of me driving home, sideswiping, a teenager on a bicycle, slamming into my own home, having the home burned down around me, all those things happening on the same day at the same time, probably, fairly remote. So when they look at you from a risk standpoint, if you have all your insurance with one company, generally it's significantly cheaper. And cheaper in my case, the phone call started with, "Hey, John, I think I can save you around $850 a year."
Yeah.
And that was my personal savings. Yeah. So it's pretty significant.
I get emails from Geico about bundling. And I just, out of laziness, I don't have homeowners insurance with Geico, but I keep telling myself I should get a quote and probably do it. But, so apparently there's some advantages to price breaks for bundling, I guess, is what they're selling.
The biggest bundle savings, I had a couple who their agent had actually passed away 5 years prior, and they just had no communication. They were put through to a call service and didn't know the name on their policy, the agent. They lived down in the water, two cars. They have to have the backup truck for taking out the trash. They have a boat. They saved $1,450 a year just by simply moving to a new company with a bundled program.
That's a lot. I got to do that.
Yeah. And then the other thing, and when I'm teaching, there's another area for large savings out there, which is on your fire insurance for your home. There's a lot of folks out there, if you think of the value of your house right now, if you haven't opened your policy lately, you really need to take a look at the limits, because you may be insuring a house for $500,000 to burn down, and the one down the street, just like yours, may be a little better, sold for $375,000. And that included the ground underneath. So when I actually did that on my primary residence, my coverage, actually the premium dropped about 6.25% a year. And again, as Bob just said, that's after tax money, so it's a pretty significant savings every month.
That's very interesting you say that, because up until the prices of housing kind of bottom dropped out, it was a little bit the reverse. People would insure their house for what they paid for it, and appreciation brought the house up. And if there was this unfortunate fire, they had a policy limit. So there were plans that provided for an annual escalation increase of X. And what we're doing here is maybe looking at it the reverse. Let's bring it down and then bring it up for a modest amount each year.
That's correct. Actually, what I would encourage folks to do is to call up their agent. Number one, if you haven't talked to an agent in 2 or 3 years, then you call your agent. I love folks that, when you call up and they say, "Hey, I was just getting ready to call you on that." And the reason a lot of folks, I got a call in the case of my agent, he said, "Hey, John, it drives referrals, because if you save this kind of money, you're going to refer two or three other folks to me." And I've sent a lot of, clients, prospects to Bill just for that reason. But you want to make sure that, A, number one, you're in a bundled policy. You also want to make sure that you are insuring your house for the correct amount from a fire coverage standpoint. And then in this area, you want to make sure that you're actually properly covered. And in another area on property casualty is on your auto insurance, underinsured motorist coverage. A lot of folks, if you dust those policies off, meaning I know you probably haven't taken them out of the envelope since you got them, but if you pull them out and you look at underinsured, uninsured motorist, you're probably covered for the state of Maryland just went to 30-60, means $30,000 per person, maximum $60,000 per accident. And I just heard the other day on the way to work a report that right now, currently, they estimate 16% of Maryland drivers are uninsured. And twice in my life, I've been actually in an accident where I've been hit, and both vehicles were driven by uninsured motorists. So if you were to be in an accident, I think any attorney out there that you work with would tell you the same thing. Your pain and suffering and things that could happen to you, unreimbursed medical expenses, they can quickly get up to the point where you're taking a loan out in your house to pay for those bills, and or you could simply be wiped out. So I would take a look at uninsured, underinsured motorist as well, and make sure that when you're talking to your agent that you're covering all of those bases.
All righty, so this has a part. Yeah, boy, how about this? It's pollen.
It's pollen season.
Me too. Mm-hmm. So this has a part, as Joe Selinger once said on a show a few weeks, there's financial planning is a lot of moving parts. So this is one of the moving parts in there. It's insurance, but it's something we kind of don't pay attention to until you get a wake-up call, like you just said. If you got an uninsured motorist, you know, how much is the liability going to be if there's a potential accident? And then the ability to do this and decrease premiums, I mean, how good is that?
That's great. You know, they come to a class, Bob, I can send them out of the class and with some action items to save them pretty significant dollars. So.
Yeah. All righty. So, I mean, well, let's look at this from the positive. It's an insurance. That's what insurance is for. It's an insurance against the unknown. But talking about maybe something we all know a little bit more about is planning for retirement at all stages of one's career, beginning, mid, and pre-retirement, and the financial planning side more and more. And you read this stuff just in this this weekend. I read in a major newspaper that one of the discussions was to increase the amount of contributions that federal employees would make to the, quote, program. Now, be this FERS or the dwindling population of CSRS. And then Mike Causey had an article about, well, you think that's bad, Bunky, just wait. There might be a pay cut. Now, none of this is in law. So don't go screaming to your office mates now and say, boy, listen to what I just heard. But you need to be aware of that. So needing to be aware of that focuses then on us having more responsibility to take care of ourselves. And with regards to financial planning, if there was another article and another thing this weekend, like I read a lot, but I do read that stuff.
The Sunday Post on the first page above the fold,
yep,
main section, talked
that's
about,
where it, yeah, I saw yeah, it, yeah,
talked about essentially increasing the CSRS and FERS contribution, employee contributions, about 5% above what they are now. So that mean that older CSRS people would be up to around 12.5%. And then Mike Causey, friend of the show, whose messy office is down the hall from us, is...
that was amazing. I've never seen that.
Yeah. But, it's but anyway...
But what comes out of the office is much more important than the papers in it.
That's right. But anyway, he wrote about that Friday. So essentially, he scooped his old employer, the Post, because they didn't have anything till Sunday, and Mike had it Friday.
But Mike is distributed nationwide. Mike's article is distributed.
Sure. I mean,
on
because it's federalnewsradio.com. And so, yes, but he had it 2 days before the Post did. But the Post saw fit to put it on the front page above the fold, so apparently they realized that that was pretty significant news for the federal population in the D.C. area.
All righty, John. So how do we, if we storm clouds, if you will, or let's say that they, you know, you lead with the left and hit with the right, so we go, we want 5%, and they'll settle for 2 or 3, whatever the percent is, if it's pay cut, that's right out of the bone. So then I guess we go shopping for insurance and try to cover somehow there. But more important, I guess you got to turn to the investment side of life. And I'm an accountant, as people probably know. So, you know, I gravitate a little bit and understand, I think, math and money. But most people don't. Otherwise, they wouldn't need accountants and financial planners, right, or benefits people.
We need them because of the tax code.
Yeah, well, the god-awful tax code. But still, you know, it's just I don't understand how this does that. And somebody will, you know, you'll be talking and say, you know, I have $100,000 in my 401k, and this person is 62 years old. And $100,000 is a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money if you're going to be drawing on it for the rest of your life. So when should they get the wake-up call? When they first start working, I suppose. But how do you twist people's arms to not necessarily buy from you or the need to recognize this at an early age?
Well, I think there's about 20 questions in there, Bob. I'm not sure. Well, we'll tackle that one the way I would do it in class. Number one, if you're not pulling out each year a net worth calculation worksheet, and I usually like to tell folks in class, you know, pull that sometime out at, you know, sometime after New Year's, preferably after the hangover, depending on what you did that night. But you want to sit down with a net worth calculation worksheet, and on one side you're putting down your assets, and the other side you're putting down what you owe. And the bottom line number on that sheet, of course, is your net worth. And there's a Texas term, I've modified it slightly. The Texas version is big hat, no ranch. My version is, of course, big hat, no cattle. And you have a tremendous amount of folks that, we'll call it the D.C. area in the country, that they have all the common terms would be flash and bling in the world, but they don't have anything to back it up financially.
Big job, no assets.
Big job, no assets. It takes you back to the loans they were doing, ninja loans, no income, jobs, or assets, which is, we're still dealing with the aftermath of that in the mortgage, in the housing market. But, and I say in class, if we reach to fill those out honestly, and I took everybody out in the hallway like they do back in elementary school and lined them up from top to bottom, there'd be a person at the head of the class and there'd be the person at the tail end of the line. And you kind of have to ask yourself as you get older, you know, where do I really want to be in that line? And if you don't look at that every year, and when I open new accounts, it's one of the know your customer rules of the stock exchange. I have to, or the NASD, I have to ask those questions. What's your net worth? And it's priceless, the blank stares that you get, because it's not a number folks are familiar with. And so if you really cut out everything else and you're not taking an assessment each year of where you're at, what you accomplished last year to make that a more positive number, there's obviously something wrong, and if you have a negative number starting out, that's what we call a spending problem in my world, and we need to definitely get that corrected. So that's the building block. That's where you start. I think that's a good wake-up call. Several good books out there. I am a fan of Dave Ramsey's book, and I was actually presented with that book, Total Money Makeover, when I was out teaching a class at a site I think was over at Commerce. And that's just a really good primer of how money works. Should you have a mortgage on your house? Should you buy a new car? Should you have a lease? But more importantly, it's a roadmap of how to eliminate your debt, typically 12 to 18 months. Put up an emergency reserve and then continue to either A, put more money in your TSP and accelerate the pay down in your house. But it's a good how-to manual. As I tell folks in class, I can damage them for 3 hours or 6 hours of financial planning, but it's really up to them to make a change in what they do. And books like that, Total Money Makeover, Dave Ramsey, I think that's a good place for folks to start.
Did he have a radio show, or does he have a national show?
He does have a national show. He does Financial Peace. I don't know, like doing a commercial for him, but I know he does Financial Peace University. But that book, I don't believe he has any formal financial training, but he has been a millionaire a couple times and been bankrupt a couple times.
Let's hit on one of the things you just mentioned. I'm sure you get this in class. I'm sure John gets it in class. I know I get it in class. Should I be paying my mortgage off? I get a tax deduction. Well, you only get a tax deduction if you spend the money. And if you use other money to pay the mortgage down, then you have less money to invest. So it's kind of, I don't know the answer varies with the person, I think. But, if you're doing it more mathematically than, trying to be a shrink, what would you tell people when they ask that?
I think the easiest answer to that one is that if you have a mortgage, and we'll just say that your mortgage is $1,000 a month, and I'm sure there's some folks out there laughing because we haven't seen that kind of a mortgage for a while. Mortgages are typically a little bit more, but for this example, the mortgage is $1,000 a month. It's the first year of a 30-year mortgage. $12,000 in payments for that year, and as a CPA, you would agree that out of that $12,000, how much is interest going to the bank?
About $11,900.
About $11,900. So all for the idea of getting a tax deduction, which will give you back how much in tax refund?
Yeah, I'd say that between federal and state, mid-career or above 30%, beginning career it's 20%.
So they're going to get back about $3,000 to $4,000, but the bank is going to get the majority of that $11,900, and it doesn't really sound like a great deal to me. And if you look at a typical mortgage, the biggest problem with any type of scenario like that is you have to take the money if you're going to use the tax deduction. You're going to use a very low interest rate on a mortgage, say 5% after the deduction. It's maybe 3%. Then you have to have the wherewithal to take that same amount of money and invest it. And unfortunately, what I see is that folks don't follow through with that. They spend it. So it's a great theory. It's a great, as I say, you're trained in credit the day you walk out of, or actually the day you walk into the student union, your first day of college. And there's a table there, and there's folks hawking credit cards to you. And, we're trained at a very young age, getting, even before we get to business or into our work lives, that credit's the way to go. I think your better plan would be to, if you have fairly good income, to accelerate the mortgage pay down, get the mortgage paid off. And if you truly want to take advantage of that tax deduction, which I'm not a huge fan of because of the front end loading of mortgage interest, do it on your second home, do it on a rental property. Do it somewhere else, but I'm just not a big fan of mortgages.
All righty, for those of you all listening, it's 10:26. It's Monday, what's today?
16th.
16th, 2011. We're on the air for about another half hour. Please call us, 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. This show is rebroadcast many times during the week. And you can get us in an email address. We'll give you that later. And if somebody wanted to contact you, John, how would they do it?
Actually, you can contact me. My office number is 301-932-0305. Or, actually, Bob's giving me the slowdown, 301-932-0305. Or via email, it's John, J-O-H-N, dot, and then my last name, Jillick, J as in John, I-L-E-K, at edwardjones.com.
Great. All righty, let's get back to becoming more liquid. We've got an emailer, a good friend of the show, actually is on the other coast from here, and he has some generally very good questions, and he had three this week, and he get one of them, and this might apply right now. Can you give me a good reason why the federal employee should be in this market since the S&P has been flat since 1999? What steps does Wall Street need to do in order for the federal employee to have confidence putting more money into our TSP accounts? And finally, is there such a thing as a magic number one needs to obtain in order to live comfortably in retirement? We could probably spend 3 days on that one, but let's try to do it a little quicker than 3 days.
No problem. Actually, we'll start with, I love this in class. I use something called the rule of 72. And for those of you listening out there, it's just simply a rule of thumb. If you take the number 72, you divide it by the rate of return, it gives you the years to double your money. So you take a savings account right now, and right now 0.5% in a savings account divided into 72 would take you 144 years at that rate to double your money.
Minus taxes, so I mean,
minus taxes,
it's generational.
Generational, And then you get into a CD, and most folks would say certificate of deposit. I would say certificate of depreciation. Right now, if you're lucky to get one of those wonderful depreciation certificates, they'll pay you maybe 2%. So in 72 divided by 2, 36 years from now, you'll have doubled that money. The only problem you have is that inflation trending at 3% into 72 takes about 24 years before prices double. And I'll go back to my first car, new car, which my first mistake, because I know it's rusting in a junkyard somewhere. That car was $15,000. The comparable car today, just 21 years later, is probably $30,000 to $35,000. So prices double. We're at $4 a gallon for gas, and I know in the D.C. area a little bit higher. I have a good friend, Glenn. He may be listening over in England right now. I know he's going to tune in on the internet, but Glenn said that he filled up his van a couple weeks ago, and it was close to $200 U.S., and it was around $9.48 a gallon, I think was the number I recall.
Is that why they have all those small cars in Europe?
It could be.
Yes.
And they have a they have a very nice train system. So, but you look at things like inflation, and you get down to the crux of the TSP, and you start looking at the funds. You have the G, the F, the C, the S, and the I. And as I like to say, the G and the F funds are your bond funds. It's your safety net. And that's unfortunately where a lot of folks like to stay, or they like to try and time the market. And to get you over in the CSI, is, and I like to say CSI stands for crime scene investigation, because when the market drops out, that's who you want to call to try to figure out where your money went to if you don't have a lot of experience. So CSI, crime scene investigation. And if you look at those two funds, and I printed out a couple of things. I printed out the TSP annual return page, but I also printed out the G and the C fund fact sheets, and it's all current information. But when I'm in class or teaching class, I like to have folks look at the annual return summary, which is 2001 to 2010. And if you look at the 10-year compound returns, and I'm just going to read them off for the G fund, 4.26%, the F fund, 5.91%, the C fund, 1.42% for the last 10 years, S fund, 6.12%, I fund, 3.45%. Anyone looking across that sheet trying to make their base financial decision of where to be this year, it would have a very tough time. And the obvious choice, or close to obvious, would be some combination of the G and the F. And unfortunately, that's where folks stop. And if you stop there, you miss out on the wonderful thing called the compounding of money over a long period of time.
That's John's mantra, right? Jack's mantra.
Yeah, the younger you are, the more aggressive you want to be. And that's just the rule of thumb. You want to be heavier into the three stock funds in the TSP or stocks in general versus bonds. And as you get older, you can get more conservative. But which leads me to a question that you may get in class. When I retire, let's say I'm 60 or in my 60s or even 50s, is there a recommended percentage you should still have in the stock market?
It's a great question, actually. I believe anything less than 50-50 almost eliminates your chance for a rising income in retirement. And when I teach, when I meet with folks on a daily basis, I'm talking about rising income. I'm probably what you would consider an income planning specialist for retirees, because once you get into retirement, you know, living on a, quote, a traditional fixed income is a great idea. But an average couple now, one of you, if you're at the retirement point, age 60 seems to be typical for the federal government. One of you, if you're married, is going to stretch it out by insurance tables to 92. And my understanding is that they may revise that. One of you may make it out to 94. So you're not talking about a short period of time. And as I draw the chart in class, it's not retire and die. It's retire and live.
Yeah, you could live easily to be, and more and more of us will, to on these Willard Scott Smucker's jars, if, for those of you who watch the Today Show. That means you're 100 plus, and there are more and more of us that are going to hit that. In fact, I just got a bad report from my doctor last month, said you might live till 110, which sounds like good news, but not really. But so there you go.
You'll still be doing seminars.
Yeah, you don't want to get too conservative too early, because you may live easily 30 years in retirement, if not more.
So, John, how do you get somebody's attention? I mean, you and I and Jack here are talking about this, and I think we understand it from what we do, but most people just don't gravitate towards math and money, or do they care to understand it? And no disrespect to them, this just is not exciting stuff. So is there, not an automatic pilot, but, you know, you get your car tuned up every now and then, you get your house, you know, you change the filters and stuff like that. I would say it's very hard for somebody to, and I'm not playing to the audience in the studio here, but it's very hard for somebody to do this on their own, the average person. So they really do need some help, whether it's reading this person's book or whether it's going to a course or whether it's going to some guy named John locally. How do you get people interested in, how do you hit them between the eyes when you give them the numbers and say, you know, you got to do this or you're not going to be able to do that, as Jack said?
It was Jack again.
Jack
That's
again.
Me, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I play into the room. I'd say the first thing you want to do is that if you are 15 years out from retirement, you need to get in front of a financial planner. Just simply to take an inventory of your life, you know, from your life insurance, should you consider long-term care, property casualty, am I saving enough? Are my investments in a place, given the rate of return I'm getting now, that are going to get me to my retirement spending goal? And what we can do, which a lot of folks try to do on a piece of paper, is that we have the wonderful thing in our office is called financial planning software. And yes, you can find it on the internet, but at some point in your life, I know my company had a great commercial not too long ago. It was a gentleman sitting at his kitchen table with surgical equipment, and he had a doctor on the other end of the phone that he was going to talk him through a minor surgery. And you shouldn't do that. You need to seek the advice of a professional at some point. You know, most folks, I would say it's the equivalent of they're lost in the woods right now. They've got a map and a compass in their hands. They've been trying to use that for years, but it's a heck of a lot better to be lost in the woods if you have a professional guide to get you out.
Let's go back to that map. You brought it up a while ago, and some people call it a balance sheet. Some call it this or that, and it's assets minus liabilities, and somebody might look at that and say, boy, this is dirt. Look at all the money I'm worth. But a number of people, a large chunk of that is tied up in a home. A home is not necessarily a liquid asset until it's sold and we move down, and then it comes to be an income producer. So if they're looking at this, they ought to really pull that out and say, this is, you know, I got to boost up the non-house portion. I'm always going to have to live somewhere. Maybe I can buy down, but I'm probably not going to fully release that equity. Somebody covered under CSRS and, quote, pre-retirement is probably a lot better off than the rest of us. And I've noticed recently, and I've said this more than a few times on the show, in the pre-retirement courses, I'm seeing 20-year-olds. And I go up to them, to the person, every time at the break, and I said, with all due respect, you're entitled to be here, but why are you here? And to the person, it's almost this. I don't want to mess up, and I want to know it now. And so even though it's pre-retirement stuff, the mechanics of money is there whether you're 60 or whether you're 26. And if you understand the mechanics of money in 26 or 36, you'll not need to be as angst at 56.
That's true. I think anyone starting out with the federal government, I do teach a lot of those classes, entry-level FERS. I applaud them for being in there. I applaud them for taking the initiative to get into a class to learn about it. I'd highly encourage them. There's books out there. Smart Women Finish Rich is the one that pops to mind. And if you're a guy, don't be embarrassed to read it. It's just a great book about saving. It talks about, of course, as John and Jack and I, or the other John and I sit here with Starbucks in front of us, he talks about David Bach in that book about the latte factor. And the cost long term of hitting Starbucks every morning and getting that grande latte, and then of course you can't just have that; you have to have the biscotti. And when you add that up and you invest that every day in a good old mutual fund over a 30-year career, it's easily $1 million over your working lifetime. And it's how you live your life, how you spend the money, and I like to see the young folks in class for that reason.
And they also have to understand their benefits that Jack talks so much about, especially with FERS. I mean, their retirement, the newbies, if you will, it's the proverbial three-legged stool, but they have to understand a piece of their retirement's going to come as a guaranteed payment through the FERS basic annuity, and if they retire early enough, they get something called a supplement. But then beyond that, Social Security, they don't have a lot of control over, but it'll probably be there. But first,
it'll be there. It just, we don't know.
May not be as much. Maybe more.
May be more means testing as the fix finally is worked on, and it will have to be someday. Of course, they keep postponing it recklessly. But, yeah, it'll be there. Because I do get that question, the assertion, oh, Social Security, that's not going to be there. Well, everybody's covered by it. So they can't just say, oh, you paid these FICA taxes all these years, but you're getting nothing for it. I mean,
you're going to get something.
You think Greece, the revolts in Greece would be they would pale in comparison to the people hitting the streets. So it'll be there in some form or another. But the lion's share, potentially, should come from your TSP account.
And the personal savings. TSP, how can you not put X percent in, because it's a match.
Well, it's a 5% match on the first 5% you
contribute. It's 100% rate of return before you lose a dollar or make a dollar.
Absolutely. Even if you pulled it out and paid the penalty in the taxes, you'd still be ahead, wouldn't you, Bob?
Yeah, and this gets to a part of the first question. Is there a magic number one needs to obtain in order to live comfortably in retirement? And I would imagine that's a constantly monitored situation, because your income changes, your lifestyle changes, your family may or may not change. And so you'd say, okay, at this age I can do this. And John, you mentioned something about some of the financial planning packages on the net. There's one on the TSP net. It's called the ballpark estimate, but, underline the word ballpark. It's a rough idea. Not a bad one, but it's one that may even wake you up. And I like what they do at the end of it. They kind of put like a chart, and then all of a sudden the red comes up and say, well, if you want to check out by the age of 68, you're fine. But if you want to live longer, this is what you got to do. And really what you have to do, if you don't understand anything more than that, is to seek professional advice.
Absolutely.
But, there is no magic number. The magic number gets back to what you said at the beginning of class. I've got certain expenses. I've got certain assets. These assets have to provide me enough income to cover the gap between my spending habits and my guaranteed income, FERS annuity, and Social Security, whatever it might be. And it's got to generate X, and it's and you can't pull out. If you're making 5 or 6%, you can't pull out 5 or 6% because it ignores inflation. And that's if you're making 5 or 6%. And as you mentioned, in the last decade, that might have been pretty good.
Well, in the last decade, I think a lot of folks fall back to that, and I'll touch on that here in a second. But the number, there's a book out there, Lee Eisenberg wrote it. It's called The Number, and it's titled A Completely Different Way to Think About Your Retirement. And it's a good easy read. It's more of it's not a technical book, but everybody has a different number. It depends on their lifestyle, what they see themselves doing in retirement. And I think the common theme, I think, for folks that are going to be okay in retirement is that they have realistic expectations. But you have a lot of folks out there that are floating around with unrealistic expectations, and that's where the disconnect comes. They see themselves living a millionaire lifestyle in retirement, and they're, as my dad would say back in the day, they're trying to do it on a beer budget. And you can't... we're not miracle workers, and the best thing you can do is get in. And I saw the ballpark estimate. Actually, I was looking at it this morning. I didn't realize that was there. That's a good place to start. But, again, I think a professional advisor looking at your numbers and helping you work through if you have some debt, consolidating that debt, eliminating that debt, or not consolidating, just eliminate it.
That's hard. It's just hard to get people to stop that.
It's hard. It's hard if you have bad spending habits and you have, as I would like to say, you got to be real careful now heading into retirement. We're seeing way too many folks come in that have what I refer to as boomerang kids and now even boomerang grandkids. And those are retirement killers. And if you're going to have your kids come back in the house for a short period of time, charge them rent. And make sure that you boot them out of the house shortly thereafter. But I've been in this, this is year 11, and I've seen folks taken down by their kids because they just were trying to fund the kids' lives. And at some point in time, and I hate the term kid when you're dealing with someone that's in their, mid to late 20s and now even in their 30s. And so there's a lot of pitfalls to retirement, but having realistic expectations, dealing with adult children or kids effectively, there's a lot of different aspects that we have to look at to come up with your number.
Yeah, and then a lot of people are maybe supporting their parents or in-laws.
Absolutely.
As well. And
so that's fair. That's fair, but that does happen.
It
absolutely
happens, unfortunately, and I would encourage any anybody in that situation, if they can get long-term care insurance for their parent or in-law, and you can through the federal plan, to do so before they actually need it, because when they need it, they're not going to be able to get it. They can, old people can be a problem if you have to support them and claim them on your 1040.
All righty, we're talking about the thrift, and we don't just bang on the thrift because we bang on it a lot, that put your money in, put your money in. And it's true, but there are some people, and this question came from our friend, and said some of his friends are anxious about putting money into the thrift because of what's happening to economies. But what do you say to that? Because the C fund, if nothing, excuse me, the G fund, if nothing else, it's government money. Is it cash? No. Is anything cash? No. You buy a stock, it's not cash, it's based on what the value is. It's a bond, it's based on the borrower's ability to pay back the bond, and I'm not being negative with that. People pay back what they owe, and most do, some don't. But I don't think, where else do you put it? Do you put it under a mattress, you know, the proverbial mattress, or the coffee cans in the backyard? I'm really dating myself with that one, but if you don't put it in the thrift, if you haven't maxed out the thrift, it's just... Well, unless you're really good managing your
own money.
I
think you should use all five funds.
And spread your risk, in other words?
Yeah, and depending on what age you are, as I said earlier, and I'm sure John agrees because this is just conventional wisdom, is put most of your money in stocks the younger you are. And what do we mean by most? Well, if you're just starting out or, you know, even if you're in your 30s, you probably want to, and correct me if you have a different opinion, John, I'm sure you will, 80% in the three stock funds and 20% in the bond funds wouldn't be a bad split, I wouldn't think.
No, that's a good base starting point. And I'll clear up, one of the hats I wear is stock broker, so I'm very familiar with what's going on with the markets. And I'm not going on a limb to say that you're probably looking at one of the most phenomenal decades coming up that you'll ever see. For several factors, it used to be the common belief that when the baby boomers, and I've got a few of them sitting here in the studio with me, started to retire, that they'd take their money and they'd start spending, and they'd inherit money, they'd spend that too, and that it was going to have a big effect on the economy. But what you're actually seeing now is it's actually interesting, the global growth of the middle class. And I've been over to China, actually, in the last 3 years. I've been there twice, and it's interesting. I don't know that John and Bob know this, but I'm the president of the Charles County Chamber of Commerce. And just a quick story, back in January when I had my presidential ball, I got a call from the local JC's Hall down in Waldorf where we held the event. And I had done a lot of fundraising, and I had a grand sponsor, and they had put up a considerable amount of money for that that position. And part of their package was a couple of bottles of Dom Perignon champagne to be on the table. And, of course, Bob's looking at me saying, where's this going? Interestingly
where's
enough.
Where's ours?
Yeah, where's ours? But interestingly enough, I said, well, hey, why can't you get it? And they go, well, our distributor, Reliable Churchill, doesn't have any. So I said, well, let me call you back. And like any other business person, I called a friend that is with Reliable, and he kind of chuckled and said that, well, not only were they out locally, they were out nationwide, and that they had just had a conference call with this CEO of Dom Perignon, who said, well, we're just not out in the U.S., we're out pretty much here as well, because what happens is you have around 1 to 1.1 billion Chinese folks, a lot of which are becoming middle class. And they do two things when they start to make money. They buy a cell phone, because you have to have a cell phone in this day and age. And the next thing they do is they buy a laptop computer. But unlike us, they don't have to wait for the World Wide Web, because it's now the Internet, and they have instant access. And so they start to search for luxury items. And they identified Dom Perignon champagne, obviously, as a luxury item. They were sold out within a six-month period from top to bottom.
So has the value of the older bottles gone up?
Apparently, you can get them in the liquor store still. They've gone up. It's like supply and demand. But so that's a little trick if you need a bottle for a wedding or something, some other event this year you may want to sneak out. But it just kind of points to the just enormous amount of demand that's going to happen. And interestingly enough, the CEO said that about 15% of that demand was also from India. And you look more recently, I'm not sure why it's not bigger news, but you had, I think the gentleman was 26-year-old on Facebook, took down the Egyptian government. And then shortly thereafter, folks saw that on the internet, and the same thing happened in, Libya?
Well, yeah. I mean,
same thing. So little did we know all this defense spending that we've been doing over the years. All we needed was to create Facebook a little bit sooner.
And drink more. There was an article I saw regarding the Chinese being embarrassed at the corporate level for how much money they spent on fine wine. It was just in the paper last week.
$250,000.
So to kind of that would argue then, I guess, that part of your portfolio always should be in foreign stocks.
Actually, no. It's if you think about it, I love the C fund because most folks when you teach, you ask them what the S&P 500 index is, which is what the C fund models, and they really have a difficult time answering the question. And then you just start throwing out names: McDonald's, Pfizer, ExxonMobil. So you got McDonald's, Disney, Colgate, Palmolive. You have all these companies out there that you have to use every day. And when tragedy does strike, the last thing you think about is going and canceling your auto insurance, not filling up on the way home, because what's the point? So the C fund is going to be around after all of us sitting here and all of the folks listening are going to be long gone.
Yeah,
still
the C
generating
fund,
those products.
But generally it's 500 of the largest domestic corporations spread out over different industries. And if one stumbles or one is on a decline, they'll pull it out and they'll put a new kid in, correct? But, I mean, they don't do it wholesale.
It's pretty static, isn't it?
It's pretty static. Yeah,
pretty static. But those companies are there, and you have to use those products every day.
Yeah. But should at least a part of your portfolio, say, if you're in the TSP, be in the I fund?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, because there's considerable value of being in the foreign markets, too. One of our financial planners that we use about the iFund, he recommends being in the iFund to some extent, but he laments the fact that it doesn't really include some developing countries. And one of them is Russia, if you consider them a developing company, but it doesn't include Russia and some really emerging economies. I think it does include South America. Which
what do they
is
call
why,
them? The BRICS? Brazil, Russia,
yeah.
India,
mm-hmm.
and China.
But I personally love international. I think even my firm's current recommendation is around 15-20%.
Yeah.
And if you take a clue from the lifestyle funds or life cycle funds, those were created, in my belief, because I'm sure when the trustees of the plan, which is the federal government, it's not a person, but when the folks out there in charge looked at it and they saw, the whole plan heavily weighted to the G fund.
That's right. That's what exactly.
I was guessing. So now, John,
no, you're right.
John or Jack has confirmed it.
Both of us. The impetus was, in fact, the Thrift Board, the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, noticed that too many, particularly young people, were totally in the G fund, and therefore would not have nearly as much money in retirement than if they diversified and got heavily into stocks. So that was the impetus of adopting the L fund model, the life cycle model. It wasn't a creation of theirs. They just took the idea and included it. And it's been around since 2005. And what it does, it's kind of hands-off investing. But it uses all five funds. And they just came out with the latest L2050 fund, which starts out at 85% stocks and 15% split between the G and the F. And that is for the young people or younger people. But that doesn't mean an older person, if they like a pedal to the metal type, that they could do that too. But it's typically designed. And then, but then they go all the way, and there's where I have some reservations about the L fund, is they all go all the way down to the L income fund, which if you look at the splits is like, I forget, it's 10 or 20% in stocks and 80%, maybe more, in, I forget the breakdown, but it's something like that.
It's 73G and it's 7% F. And it's funny that John
and
said
that. John just got through saying to an earlier question I posed to him, that even in retirement, it should be about a 50-50 split.
Correct.
And so why would you...
Well, then you don't have to necessarily use that. You can always go out.
Now, oh, sure.
About 3 weeks ago, we had the director of the thrift on and the PR person, if you will, and it was a great show. And it was three weeks ago, and you can listen to it on our website. And we don't sell anything. NITPINC.com, and just click back about 3 weeks ago, and was good. But what we also talked about is the Roth TSP that's going to be available sometime. And write this down: the second quarter of 2012. It's not April 1st guaranteed. It's the second quarter, whenever that's going to be. Mm-hmm. You've got 3 months to choose from. We talked about, you know, why should you do it? And probably I would imagine somebody younger ought to jump all over this, especially beginning career, and if they forego the tax benefit of putting money in the thrift, the compounding of the earnings over a lifetime at a young age is going to be staggering, and who knows what they'll do with the Roth. I have no idea what they're going to do with the Roth.
Quickly, before we run out of time, and John could explain this, certainly, how does a Roth work versus the traditional IRA or traditional TSP?
Well, the quick is... that with a Roth, the money that you put in is after-tax money. You're not getting the upfront tax break on it. And after 59 and a half, the money is completely tax-free.
Coming out.
Coming out under current legislation. Yeah. And I think I kind of heard Bob alluding to that.
But you don't pay taxes on the earnings year by year while you're
No, it grows tax deferred.
If you leave it in there, pay taxes.
You don't get the tax
it.
Deferred. It's a trade-off.
You don't get the tax deduction when you put it in, but you get the tax deferral along the way.
But somebody at a younger age, the tax deduction might not mean as much to them at a later age.
That's correct.
So as they progress through.
I think that a Roth
screaming.
Is a terrific idea.
Well, where it comes into play is for folks that are retired, they've got taxes on the money that they pull from their thrift or if they roll it to an IRA from the IRA. But when you get that special offer for a cruise to the Bahamas, it's nice to be able to pull that money out tax-free and not have it add to your taxable income.
Yeah.
So.
And actually, even you can pull money out of the Roth first, and it's non-taxable. It's not like a traditional IRA. That's another show. John, final comments?
I would get in front of a financial planner as soon as you can if you're about 15 years out. Take the time to read a couple of those books that I threw out there. If you didn't quite get them, I'll take emails, phone calls, but definitely if you're not taking hold of your financial future, then I would get a good start on it.
Jack?
Yeah, a lot of people don't use the TSP calculator at TSP.gov, and that's an education in itself. You should always use that in your financial plan.
Okay.
And happy Victoria Day for our Canadian.
All righty. And listen, next week, I've got Bob Braunstein and James Marshall on. Everything you ever wanted to know about federal benefits and more. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Do you want to know how to manage stress, do more with less? Work well with your political boss? Protect your professional liability? If you're a senior executive or an SES candidate, you can't afford to miss